Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight I'm joined by one guest, Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
And our topic tonight is Watchmen. We will be focusing on the HBO miniseries from 2019, but we will also be branching off and discussing the comics and the Zack Snyder film, and this will be our first real dive into a property in this way. And since there's only two of us, our typical question and answer is going to be a little different, so this should be fun and different. Excuse me. So, you know, I'll start off by saying this. Watchmen was a book that I came to a little late. I came to it well before the movie, but I started reading comics when I was a kid, and I remember seeing Watchmen on the stands when I was young and not reading it because, you know, whatever. I was into different types of books back then. But I kept hearing about Watchmen all through my teenage years. And finally, when I was about 20, 21, I finally picked up a copy at Borders and read it. And it was amazing. Now, I don't consider it the greatest graphic novel of all time. I think the best comic book series of all time is Sandman, but that's a topic for another show. But, you know, I was like, how are they ever going to make a movie of this and do it justice? I said, I can see what they'd have to do. And honestly, one of the things that they had to do was what Zack Snyder did, which was change the Squid, which is not something they did in the HBO series. So, you know, and I think that's interesting that one of the things that I think actually works for a very interesting reason, they figured out how to make it work, but maybe it worked because there's more time to delve into it and give it context in the series. But we'll get into that. So, I guess this is the one time we'll really ask a question, but what about you, Aaron? How did you come to Watchmen?
So I am an average reader of all things. Time magazine included Watchmen on the 100 greatest novels of the 20th century. So it was on my radar for a very long time. This would have been in 2005, so the year I graduated from high school. But I just never got around to reading it. And then I saw the film. I was like, I have to read that book, and still did not get around to it. It's one of those books that it's so popular and it's so important that book sales never happen for it. And so it was always like $30, $40, and I was just never willing to pull the trigger. Finally, I saw it at the library, and I was like, okay, it's happening. I had just blazed through The Sandman, which I also consider the greatest comic book of all time. But then I blazed through Watchmen, and man, if it's not right up there, it's much shorter work. It is much more of a novel than a series. And its themes are so resonant. And it was written in 1985 about a slightly varied timeline version of 1985. But it felt so real. And it felt so immediate and haunting that way. So that's how I came to the book. I did see the film opening weekend. I did not see the film again until this last week when I finally saw the extended version.
The ultimate cut.
So, yeah. So, which is pretty much spot on to the novel until the very, very end.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, and the thing that we're talking about, there are going to be spoilers in this show, folks. There's just no two ways about it. So look away now, but please come back once you are ready for spoilers. You know, the fear squid that Ozymandias creates in the book. Brilliant idea.
Mm-hmm.
So well illustrated by Dave Gibbons. You know, those like 10 or 12 pages in the final issue where you see the squid, you see what's happened to New York City, the 3 million dead. You know, and I think Zack Snyder was correct in saying, you know, I only have like 2.5 or 3 hours maybe to put this film on screen. And to make the squid work, I just don't know if I'm going to have the time to make that work. I could put it in here, but I have to, but like in the book, I'm going to have to do more to explain it. And so I think he was correct in doing something that everybody would understand, even people who weren't fans of the book, and that's a bomb, you know. So having the bomb,
yep.
That, and especially, you know, and also it works in the context of the Cold War, and it works, you know, since Dr. Manhattan has all those nuclear Cold War overtones anyway as a character and in his name. I mean, Dr. Manhattan, the Manhattan Project. So, you know, it really does work.
So
I just
without getting,
go on.
No, without getting too far into Zack Snyder as a filmmaker, I think his greatest flaw as a filmmaker is that he often bows to the source material. That's the biggest flaw with 300. It's the biggest flaw in anything he works on, is that he will give precedent to the source material. And I think in Watchmen, is the one time in his career that he said, you know what, I cannot follow him down this road, and made the wise decision to change the ending without actually changing the ending. He changed what happened without changing the context, without changing the meaning of the ending.
Right.
And it's, I think, one of the more brilliant pieces of, like, original writing that he's done.
Oh, yeah. And you know, and we're going to have to discuss this movie and then and the book, of course, before we go to the TV show, because the TV show, of course, is a sequel or a companion, a continuation of the book. But, you know, the movie is so damn close to the book, and the book is so good. And then you talked about watching the ultimate cut, which put back the Tales of the Black Freighter, and also as an extra included the Behind the Mask. Now, did you get to see the Behind the Mask material?
I don't have the Behind the Mask material, so I was not able to see that, but I am curious, so... Would love
yeah,
to hear it, about it.
It's pretty much just like when you read the book. They did a really good job with that. But you know, we've talked about the differences between this, and this is also to set up, you know, the not just the fact that they have the squid in the series, but one thing that the book did have. And you talked about the tensions in the 80s and that it was a slightly different timeline. Well, yeah, you know, you have Nixon being president for fucking ever. Reagan is around, but not as president. And yet it makes a point of how Nixon and Reagan, you know, were kind of similar in a way. And that the Nixon followers and the Reagan followers had a lot of similarities. And the book doesn't get into it as much as the series does, but there's racial undertones in the book that really get brought to the fore in the series. And if anything for me makes the series stand out, it's the way the series finally does the Tulsa Massacre justice in terms of memory and legacy. And that's really for me what the series is all about, is memory and legacy and dealing with the consequences of a really awful past, you know, something that Watchmen kind of hinted toward, but because of where Moore ended it, and he ended it where he ended it, so I think so that audiences could think for themselves. But Lindelof, of course, you know, said, hey, what if it's 30, 35 years later, what would this be like? And I think that, you know, he kind of ends the series in another place where, yeah, you know, maybe there's starting to be some consequences, but we don't get to know. So what do you think of that?
Oh, man.
I know that's a lot to digest, but...
So for starters, yes, the book has an all-white cast. Except for Hooded Justice,
who we didn't know
nothing about. whom, according to the TV show, was actually black.
Yep, and damn it, I don't care what other material has said.
They make such a convincing argument that I can't be convinced back. Yeah, it's canon. But all that aside, he is coded white in the book. Though, again, he never takes his hood off, so he's not that coded. Context. You sent me an article right before Showtime from the New Yorker. And it reminded me of the line in episode 4, I believe, the end of 4, beginning of 5. It's dangerous to take someone else's nostalgia. And then Nussbaum says a line that could be the show's motto.
Yeah.
And not just the show's motto. Guys, this could be America's motto. Every time that something horrible happens in America, it's because somebody is taking someone else's nostalgia. And the way that Lindelof and company, especially Regina King, who, God bless that woman, is amazing in everything she does.
She's a national treasure.
She has been an amazing producer. She's getting her directing career underway now. She's a national treasure, as you just said. They took the world that Moore and Gibbons created and just blew it up. And I mean that in the they expanded it, not in that they killed it.
No.
Things that were just visual cues, like nostalgia. There's a line, there's not even a line about nostalgia, but there's a billboard for nostalgia in both the book and the film, but there's no reference to what it is. Maybe a throwaway line at some point about it being an illegal drug. But they make it a main subplot. The way they explore policing in America, the way they turn it on its head and ask, is it still okay? They ask some really hard questions in this miniseries. And I think that they do a serviceable job, and most of the time an excellent job, in at least leaving breadcrumbs for the viewer to answer those questions.
Yeah.
It's dense. There is so much going on. There's the main plot of Sister Night Sister.
Mm-hmm.
Sister Night, sorry. And then there's, what, six main subplots that you see at least hints of in every single episode? Like, this
is and you know, people say, and people might say, oh my God, it's just Lindelof doing his Lost thing. No, this isn't Lindelof being manhandled by ABC and Disney and getting his threads torn apart. This is him juggling six or seven things, and it's dense, but you're able to follow it, and it all makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, yes, it plays with some of the same ideas and some of the same complexities as Lost, but it does it with much more grace.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell, I mean, it's nine episodes. He knew from the start where it was going.
Yep.
And he built those themes and those ideas throughout it.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is that the episode that we're going to probably focus on the most, or there's two or three episodes we can focus on. But in the comic book, there was a man named Hooded Justice, and Hooded Justice never took his hood off. He was the first costumed hero. He was a founding member of the first superhero team. Now, we have to understand, in the Watchmen universe, other than Dr. Manhattan, no one had superpowers. No one had superpowers. Even one of the villains who acted like he had superpowers used drugs and hypnosis and just had a deformity. He wasn't actually...
kind of like Batman Scarecrow or Spider-Man's Mysterio that way.
Yep. And in episode 6, Angela Ebar, who is married to Cal, and is played by Regina King, has been arrested and manages to get a hold of a vial of her grandfather's pills, her grandfather's nostalgia pills. She swallows the whole fucking vial. This is not a good thing physically. But the entire next episode, called This Extraordinary Being, which is the episode that won the Emmy for writing that year in a miniseries, then details the story of her grandfather, played by Louis Gossett Jr. as an old man. And God, I can't remember. I have to look the actor's name up. I just had it.
Abdul Mateen.
Well, that's the guy that plays Cal.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that's who you were wanting.
No. You see her grandfather as a young man, joining the police force, and you see how Hooded Justice came to be, because, yes, her grandfather, it turns out, is Hooded Justice. Now, in the comic book series and even in the movie, they keep the idea that, A, no one knows who Hooded Justice was, and, B, rumors of his being gay helped drive him away. Now, in the series, they keep the gay stuff. They reveal that he's black, but what they also have done in the series is the series starts out with a little boy about 5 or 6 years old watching an old silent film in a theater in Tulsa. And it's about the, black...
Will Reeves.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It's about him. He's the...
Bass Reeves.
Sorry, yeah, Bass Reeves. That's what it was. Bass Reeves. He was the black lawman of Oklahoma. And this is a true historical character. Very interesting character. So they're having this little black boy watch a silent film about an historic black figure, and the name of it is Trust in the Law. Well, just as this film ends, and the little boy is watching this dignified black man say, no, we're not going to fall to mob violence. We're going to take him in. We're going to trust in the law. His father busts into the theater, toting a gun, and grabs him. A riot has broken out outside. It's the Tulsa Massacre, the end of Black Wall Street, where white racists went in, burned down homes and businesses, killed and injured dozens upon dozens of people. And so what you have is you have this little boy who survived the Tulsa Massacre, saw everybody he loved or knew die, and then becomes a police officer and gets involved in a plot by white supremacists to convince black people to harm themselves. And while uncovering this plot, he is hung in a tree, cut down, and told, don't go nosing around in white people's business. Well, as he's coming home from this, still carrying the hood they put around him and the rope that they cut him down from after hanging him in the tree for a few seconds to scare him, he comes upon a couple being beat up in an alley. And you see him put on the hood, and he saves them. He goes home, and his wife actually tells him, no, you need to do this. And the thing is, the whole episode, there's memories bleeding in where you see Angela as Will, and you see Will seeing things that may or may not be memories of him as a child. You see pianos on the street. And it's so much about memory and hatred and working past anger and fear. And the episode really may be one of the most profound statements on the deep wounds that bigotry have caused this nation. So I just, want to know, and we'll get back into that, but what do you have to say?
About the episode?
The episode, yeah.
If I had a list of the greatest television episodes of all time, this would be on it.
Yeah.
Outside of the cinematic works of Charlie Kaufman, I don't think anything has ever touched on memory the way this does. The way that it injects raw emotion, dream logic, surrealism, just real pain, real anger. They play it all so well that none of it, and anything they did in that episode could have just been horribly misguided, and it all worked. Like, none of it felt like a gimmick. None of it felt like, let's do a David Lynch episode. None of it felt like that. They just, they went for it, and they nailed it. It's a masterpiece of, how long is it? It's, what, 50 minutes, 58 minutes?
Yeah, about 52 minutes or so. Yeah, 58 maybe.
It's a 9-episode piece of work. And all of it's great. But this isn't a string of the 3 best episodes.
Yeah.
The episode
maybe the
leading
four
up
best.
To this one. Yeah, Probably. Yeah, starting with episode 4, going through episode 7, it's just unreal how good it is.
Yeah, for me, it's probably episodes 5, 6, which is this one, 7, and then 8. And 7 may be the weakest, but...
Oh, you know what? 8
yeah.
is amazing, too.
Yeah. So we'll get into 8. But, you know, the thing is... One of the things, and you know, we talked about the racism, but here you have this guy who no one knows is black except for one person in the group who is his lover. And his lover, who is the head of the group, marginalizes him and ignores him and pushes him to the side. Now his lover happens to be a rich, influential white guy who's blonde and blue-eyed and the face of the franchise. Doesn't that just speak volumes about so much of the black experience in the United States over the last several hundred years?
It absolutely does. And you know what? No one I've read talking about this series, the thing that it does maybe better than anything I've ever seen, and that's a bold statement for really not having analyzed it at all before I said it, but I'm going to stand by it for now, is exploring intersectionality. Not just what does it mean to be black, but what does it mean to be black and a woman? Black and queer, black and a cop. Like, that's not easy in America.
Yeah. Barry Jenkins and Spike Lee have done some of this.
Yeah. I mean, some of the great black auteurs touch on it.
And then, I just forgot her name. The lady that did Watermelon Woman has done a little bit of this.
Yeah, yep. And Dee Reese did a little bit of it in Pariah. Mudbound is spectacular, too, but it doesn't deal with race in the same way. It does deal with race, black soldiers, and Oh, God, that's a great movie.
we could do a whole episode on that one, too, but...
But that's not the point. The way that it explores Will's story, and then how it then filters Will's story into Angela's story, because Angela was born in Vietnam. Because if you're not familiar
with
Watchmen,
which is now a state,
anthology,
it is now
the 51st state after Dr. Manhattan single-handedly won the Vietnam War. It's then been colonized. It became the 51st state. But there's still a lot of resistance and still a lot of terrorism that happened in Vietnam. And Angela's parents died in a terrorist attack for a Vietnamese freedom fighter.
Yep.
So she holds a lot of this hate, too, even though she did not grow up in America as we know it. Even though the racism of the continental U.S. did not directly affect her in her formative years.
She still experienced things.
The violence of American racism still affects her. And it bleeds into her through her Vietnamese experience. Through her, she then has the experience of being a policewoman and a policeman. And someone who's been violently oppressed, but also an oppressor, because let's remember, her father was in Vietnam as an occupying soldier. Her mother was a Vietnamese resident. And so there's just so much conflict in Angela already that when she takes Will's toxic memories, it just sets off a chain of events that is just impossible to look away from. Without ever feeling gross or exploitative either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, the show, you know, we're gonna have to go back to the beginning, but there's so much that this show does, and we're gonna have to talk about the book and then the show and the book and the show. But in the book and the movie, there is a character called Rorschach, and Rorschach is a loner. He's a conspiracy guy. He's paranoid, but he's not always wrong. In fact, he's right more often than he's wrong, because he really is a brilliant detective. He's just a slightly crazy, mean son of a bitch.
He's really
did go through a lot of shit
to the extreme.
Yes, yes. And what he did is, he figured out what the hell happened in the book, and he wrote it all down in his journal. And his journal was delivered to a right-wing newspaper. His journal gets, and that's how the book ends, with Rorschach's journal possibly getting published. Even though even though that would then, you know, fuck up Ozymandias' plan of making Dr. Manhattan and the Squid the Fall Guys. Flash forward for the series. Rorschach is now the symbol for what's called the Seventh Cavalry, a right-wing, far-right-wing, white supremacist organization. And it's very interesting that what Lindelof has said here is, once you're dead, there's nothing you can do about how groups appropriate you. So what do you think about the Rorschach appropriation by the Seventh Cavalry says in the series?
I think that a better question might be, why did they choose to appropriate Rorschach? And I think it's pretty clear. I think that as brilliant as Rorschach was, that his unhinged behavior lended itself to kind of quasi-fascist reactionary vigilantism. Vigilante obviously gets thrown around a lot when talking about superheroes. It's one of the themes of the superhero genre. But Rorschach actually is. nothing is outside his purview. His teammates can't stand him. So,
yeah, I mean, this is a guy
who
threw somebody down an elevator shaft just because they annoyed him.
Yeah. Lindelof's right. Once you're dead, you can't stop someone from appropriating your image. But when you make an image that is that ready-made for that group, you can't blame them either.
And I think there's something to be said there. I think that is basically, be careful the legacy you leave behind, because it may not be the one you're hoping for.
Right.
Watch your actions.
and just while we're on that, Jackie Early Haley, my
in
lord.
In the film, oh, God, yeah.
I don't know what happened to him. He had an amazing run from like 2006 to 2010 and then fell right back off the map. But man, he gave some incredible performances for that 4 or 5 year stretch.
Yeah, he was up for an Oscar or two. Former child actor.
A little, yeah.
But no, he actually, I have to look it up, see what he's done most recently.
He's done some work, but not a lot, and a lot of voice work, I think.
Yeah, he's apparently going to be in a film co-starring Billy Bob Thornton and Robin Wright, based on a novel by David Joy called Where All Light Tends to Go.
Interesting.
And,
he's
actually
really dark characters. He was nominated for his Oscar for his work in Little Children, in which he plays a child rapist. Then he plays
Isn't he also a drug addict in that?
Yes. He played Rorschach. He played Freddy Krueger, who's also a child rapist. People forget. God, wasn't he in Little Lovely Bones, too? Which was a horrible movie that Peter Jackson made, but a really fine performance.
Yeah, let me see.
From
him he was in Shutter Island. He was in Shutter Island.
That's right.
He was in Shutter Island, and yeah, he was in Shutter Island, All the King's Men, the remake of that, he was also in Lincoln as Alexander Stevens.
Okay, so he was not in Lovely Bones.
No, that was... you might be thinking of Stanley Tucci.
Oh, you're right.
The other thing is, you know, we keep talking about legacy and memory and overcoming or succumbing to pettiness, fears, hatred. And in the series, you have the first episode introduces Don Johnson as Sheriff Judd, who is the mentor and longtime friend of Angela Abar, played by Regina King. And at the end of the first episode, he's found hanging in a tree. He's been murdered. And an old man, played by Louis Gossett Jr., who we later find out is Will Reeves, who we later find out is Hooded Justice, is sitting there. He, at the beginning of the second episode, admits to killing him. The first episode ends with a rendition of the song from Oklahoma, Old Judd is Dead. And I want to use this as a way of, and you know, when I sat there watching this, I was already totally in. But that made me love the show even more. But both the film and the series have an amazing use of music, both songs and score. So I just want to ask you, is there anything that stands out in the use of music in either?
As I watched the film yesterday, I was seriously thinking, has anyone other than Martin Scorsese and Wes Anderson ever used a rock score better than Zack Snyder did in that film? His use of music in every scene is perfect. The use of Sound of Silence over the funeral scene, the infamous use of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah over one of the most over-the-top sex scenes ever. which includes a flame-throwing orgasm.
Literally.
As the chorus of Hallelujah starts. Hey, it's so over the top, but it's so perfect. And both because of that song. I can't stop laughing.
Yeah, and you know, no, but the thing is you have Tyler Bates doing the music for the movie, and then you have Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross doing the music for the show, for which they won the Emmy. But it's not just the scores, their use of their selection of music. And you know, we talked about this, I mean, seriously, Snyder, Anderson, and Scorsese may be the best, at least, you know, that I can think of for using pre-existing music. I mean, Robert Altman wasn't bad. Robert Altman wasn't bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I didn't think I was going to see it on TV. I mean, you know, Homicide's long gone, and that's really the only show that I've ever seen on TV that used music that way until Watchmen. So I mean, the use of music, you know, you talk about it in the movie, but in the show, it's not just the use of, like, you know,
right,
of the stuff from Oklahoma, but what about when everything goes sideways in episode 8, and all of a sudden, I Am the Walrus starts playing, or was it at the end of 6? I Am the Walrus starts playing, and all and everything's gone crazy because, yeah, but no,
yeah.
We now I think have to turn to episode 8. Now we've talked about Dr. Manhattan, and at the end of the movie in the book, Dr. Manhattan fucks off to who knows where, but he can't be around anymore because people are pissed at him. They've united. They would try to destroy him. He's vanished. People think he's on Mars as the series begins, and as we find out, he has been on Jupiter and other places, but mostly Jupiter and mostly actually Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. And we see him come and meet Angela Abar. Well, we find out at the end of the previous episode, Angela goes home and says, "Baby, I'm sorry to do this, but it's time." And she smashes her husband's forehead in with a hammer, and a blue light emerges. Holy fuck, the husband we've been watching for 7 episodes is Dr. Manhattan. Now we're going to get an episode that shows what the hell was up with Dr. Manhattan. And if we think we've been down the rabbit hole already, nope.
With, may I say, the greatest pun title of all time.
Yes, a god walks into a bar.
And just so you know, the episode starts with Dr. Manhattan walking into a bar. So it's double entendre all the way.
Yep. And then in that episode, in the next one, we find out that he made a deal with Angela's grandfather, because Dr. Manhattan, if you're not aware, sees and experiences all of time and space at the same time, except for this 10-year period. And this 10-year period is where he has decided to not be Dr. Manhattan anymore in terms of knowing who and what he is. Well, once he's unleashed, he is revealed as having a conversation with her grandfather 10 years earlier. And Angela says, "Oh, you're talking to him now." "No, I'm talking to him then." "Oh, well, then ask him why he killed Judd. And Manhattan
nothing makes
asked
sense
him,
until as things emerge.
Yep. And he
it
asked him a question.
Riddles.
And, you know, the way that she phrased her question to her grandfather is actually what caused her grandfather to kill her best friend and help kickstart the problems. And she realizes that she started everything. And then it's like, oh, chicken and the egg, which, of course, Dr. Manhattan mentions. Now, some people have said that this episode was a little heavy-handed, that the final episode with all this was a little heavy-handed, but I think it actually works. What about you?
It has to be, right? How many, I'll phrase it that way, how many just typical comic book / HBO fans are going to understand quantum mechanics enough that they're going to get this if it's subtle? Like,
yeah,
it has to be heavy-handed so that it's obvious. It has to be obvious because there aren't enough people who are going to understand what's happening, why Dr. Manhattan knows all of this. Like, it's just it has to be spelled out. It's one of those things. And usually I am all for nuance and subtlety, but in this case, I think it had to be done.
Yeah, and you know, and that's the thing. This is a series that is both heavy-handed and nuanced, that is both graceful and forceful. They found the perfect balance. They knew when to pull back. They knew when to charge ahead. It's really quite breathtaking. I remember that I missed when it was first on, and I was like, shit, I missed it. And then it won all these Emmys, and I was like, wait, what? I said,
yeah,
I know I heard people
same.
Talking well of it, but I was like, God damn. And I finally caught it. You know, now people that listen to the show may know that I have a top 300. This thing is knocking on the door of my top 100. It's not quite in my top 100. But it's right outside there. It's in, like, the top 110 or so, with some revisits, both of this material and some of the stuff ahead of it. It may enter. Actually, after this, I'm looking at it right now. It's at 108, and I should probably push it without pushing anything, without seeing anything else. I'm probably going to put it right here at about 105 after the show. So, yeah, it's quite a monumental work, you know, and I love comics, but comic book movies and TV shows have always been problems for me because they miss the, and this is going to make people cringe, but the deeper literary and humanitarian or the humanist, the emotional aspects of the best of comics, things like Sandman, Why the Last Man, Fables. Yeah, I know I'm listening to a lot of DC Vertigo stuff, but it is what it is. And, you know, you look at something like, oh, I don't know, Arrow. let's forget Arrow. We need more comic book adaptations. We need more comic book shows that take it seriously like this. And when I say seriously, I mean understand that the material can have depth. Because this is still a fun show. There is still a lot that's really fucking funny. Like one of the last scenes in the show is you have Lori Blake, the second Silk Spectre, who is now an FBI agent, and Ozymandias, and and then Mirror. Well, Mirror's played by Tim Blake Nelson. Laurie is played by Gene Smart. And Ozymandias is played by Jeremy Irons. And
brilliantly.
Yes. And they've just saved the day by sending frozen squids to crush the villain and the equipment that she was using to try to turn herself into the new Dr. Manhattan after taking his powers and for herself, which involved killing him, sucking him, you know, destroying him, re-atomizing him. And he's in the middle of this speech about, you kept my secret all this time. You're an accomplice, and how dare you? I've saved the world twice now. You, and all of a sudden, Mirror just knocks him over the head with a wrench and says, that fucker just talks too damn much. And Laurie goes, yeah, and I've had to listen to it for 50 years. It's, you know, and it manages just these hilarious moments. But even when it's not being outright funny, it has such an energy that you never get bothered by the darkness in a way that makes you go, yeah, I just don't want to watch it. I think it's far too compelling. At least it was for me. And I will say this, my girlfriend, she saw the movie. She hasn't read the book, but she saw the movie. And she has seen most of the series. Now, she does not care for superhero stuff, especially the big brawling type of superhero movies. She likes this, and it's because it's all about character and story and a solid plot, and there's political stuff, and there's real human emotion in this. And, you know, that may seem a big statement, but, you know, I think that's something that Lindelof really did and crew, he and his writers really nailed in this. You know, when Dr. Manhattan is about to be destroyed and he sent everyone to safety except for Angela, who has been his wife for 10 years, he says, I know what we, she says, what are you doing now? I'm remembering everything that happened during those 10 years. I know everything now. And she says, but come on, let me save you. No, there's nothing that can happen. Well, why didn't you send me with them? Why didn't you send me with them? Because I don't want to be alone when I die. Yeah, if that doesn't get you by the time you've watched the previous, like, 8.5, 8:50, 8:45, you probably don't have a pulse.
Especially because keep in mind, this is happening within about 15 minutes of you finding out that Cal isn't Cal. Like,
yeah, this is so, like an episode and a half later. Yeah.
You mentioned the nuance with the heavy-handedness. I just wanted to add that so much of the nuance actually comes through the form of heavy-handedness, but in a subversive way. There is a scene that I thought was a little troubling at the beginning of the series, in the very first episode.
I think I know the one you're going to talk about.
A regiment of black police officers goes into a shanty town, which they called Nixonville's, reflection of the Depression, and just beat the tar out of racist hillbillies. And you find yourself cheering because who doesn't like to see racist hillbillies getting the tar beat out of them? But then you're like, wait a second. I can't cheer for cop police brutality for one side and not the other. And
yeah.
All of a sudden you're like questioning yourself and the morality of it. And then you're like, oh, man,
yeah.
What did they just do to me?
And can we also say that because of a racist incident years before called the White Knight, where cops were beaten and killed by racists, cops are now allowed to wear masks. And one of the incidents that kicks off the episode is a man in who turns out to have a Rorschach mask and be one of the 7th Cavalry is stopped by a black police officer who requests that his weapon, because they're not allowed to carry their weapons, without calling ahead and saying, hey, I have this, 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 and this. It meets all these criteria, release my gun. Well, while he's getting his gun, he's murdered. And
so what you have is an
angry police officers, most of them black, not all of them, but most of them black, going in and beating the shit out of white bigots, and some that aren't, just some that are just having to be poor white people, but probably mostly bigots. I mean, like 90% of them are bigots.
It's definitely implied that most of them are, that this is like a racist area.
Yeah, but, you know, it really makes you think, yeah, you know, police are still police, and should we ever be rooting for a lack of due process, no matter how satisfying a beating may seem? These people are criminals. These people are supposed to be upholding the law. And remember that
right.
The show begins with the kid that will become Will Reeves watching Bass Reeves say, trust in the law.
Trust.
Don't fall to mob violence.
Yep. But what happens when the cops are leading the mob violence, even if they're on the right side of the moral issue?
And that's the thing. There's a lot of narrative and thematic consistency in this work. And, the character work really is what drives it. You know, I keep mentioning Will, and we've mentioned Angela. We've mentioned one other character, Mirror. Do you have anything to say about him? Because he got his own episode, and it was a doozy.
Oh, Tim Blake Nelson is great in everything, first of all.
Yep.
Without spoiling anything, by the way, Adam, he is in the final scene of Nightmare Alley, the new one.
Yeah, I need to see that one day.
When you first meet Mirror, you think, okay, so he's the Rorschach replacement, right? Like, that's how they have him set up. He's a bit of a hillbilly. He's a bit of a hothead. But no, he is maybe the most moral center we have in the series. Which is
and
bold.
And he's been traumatized, as we find out.
Yes. He is such a great character in ways that are hard to express, because he doesn't do that much. But he's almost the flip side of Rorschach. He still does the psychological angle to things. He is the center of the story to some degree. I mean, it's Angela's story, but he is a gravitational pull of his own, whereas like Rorschach is the literal center of Watchmen, not the moral center. But let's not think that. But he is.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that you mention that, because remember, in the book you have Rorschach at Karnak, which is Ozymandias' Antarctic base, saying, "You just killed 3 million people. The world has to know." And then he gets killed for it. Well,
nope.
The last time we see Mirror, Laurie, and Ozymandias, Ozymandias is on the floor after Mirror has knocked him out, and Laurie, who is now with the FBI, is getting ready to drag him away on the Owl Ship, Archie from the original. But a few minutes before, he'd said, no, you need to go to prison. And that's what had set him, had set Ozymandias off. And he said something very similar to what Rorschach. He said, 3 million people. You killed 3 million people in New York. And the world is going to know now, and you're going to pay. So it's almost like it took someone with some
moral fiber
to finally get what Rorschach couldn't, to finally accomplish what Rorschach couldn't, and to do it
now,
from the same fucking spot that Rorschach set it in, literally the same spot.
To be fair, which Ozymandias does not deserve, but
no.
we're going to play fair here. And I'm not going to spoil anything, because I think this is the best twist in the show. quite frankly. Ozymandias did serve time for his crimes against humanity.
Yeah, you know, we did talk about spoilers, but I don't know for those who haven't, I don't know if I want to say much about the Ozymandias story other than he's around, and I'm not going to say anything about how he connects back up with the other characters, but that's a heck of a story. And I really do think it's one of the few stories where you kind of need to watch it unfold for it to have the power that it does.
Yes.
It is really maybe the only one that you do. I mean, the Dr. Manhattan reveal is fine.
I mean, that was spoiled by the Emmys.
Yeah. But, yeah, because they didn't announce him as Cal Abar, and it was Cal Abar / Dr. Manhattan. And you're like, ah, motherfuckers! Although, at the time, I was thinking, wait, did they just spoil it? And like, well, you know, it wouldn't be the first time a show used it. I tried to put that out of my head, but then I was like, nope. All the signs pointed, and I was like, yep.
Yep.
So when the reveal came, I kind of had an inkling, but it wasn't
it was
as much as it would have been when it – yeah. But it's still it's still so well handled that you can go in with probably 80% spoilers and still be absolutely fucking floored by this thing.
Yeah.
And you know, and we've talked about the story and everything, but you know, this is a show that the cast is Regina King, Don Johnson, Tim Blake Nelson, Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, Andrew Howard, Jacob Ming Trent, Tom Meissen, Sarah Vickers, Dylan Schombing, Louis Gossett Jr., Jeremy Irons, Gene Smart, and Hong Chau, among others. this is, you know, just a huge, huge cast. And this is also not to, sorry, I also forgot that there's also Frances Fisher as Judd's wife. that they managed to get Jim Beaver and Lee Ferguson in, Michael Imperioli, you know,
What's the last thing that Jim Beaver wasn't in, though?
Yeah, Jim's in a lot of stuff, but you know, he keeps himself busy. it's an extraordinary cast. It's not just the names; it's how perfect. I can't imagine anyone else getting these roles, having seen these people. You know, I actually liked the casting in the film, and I thought it was pretty much perfect. But I can't imagine anyone else playing the roles as older characters or the newer characters, period, after having seen it. You know, Laurie, wow.
Well, yeah, when I was watching the film yesterday, I was like, Ozymandias, they nailed him here. But Jeremy Irons, as the continuation of him, is equally brilliant. It's Jeremy Irons. He's more brilliant. But when I remember texting you the first time I watched it, and I was like, wait, is that Jeremy Irons? Because, like, the thought of him even being in even a serious comic book role was just absurd until you see it. And, yeah, he chews the scenery, but he's supposed to. Like, that's Adrian Vett. Like...
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, this is his second role in a DC property. Because
right.
Let's not forget
he
that he
Alfred.
Played Alfred in the DCEU.
That's right.
But you know, he's just so good here, and you know, honestly, I think, you know, he got nominated for lead actor probably because of his name and that they had little bits and pieces of him in all the episodes. But honestly, you know, Yahya Mateen II, he deserved the Emmy.
Yeah.
But I have to wonder if they'd put Irons in supporting if he might not have snuck in a win he's Jeremy Irons, and B, it really is more of a supporting role.
They did run Yahya Abdul-Mateen as a supporting.
Yep, and that's what I'm saying. That's why I'm saying had Irons been in Mateen's
running against
category.
His castmate.
Yeah,
okay.
I think they cheated just a little bit with Irons going into lead.
Yeah, probably. They have about the same amount of like screen time. There's really not a male lead in the series.
Yeah, and that's something interesting, you know, for a show that has as many male characters, you know, you're going to remember Vite, and you're going to remember Manhattan, and you're going to remember Mir. But honestly, this is Angela, Laurie, and Chow's story, or Lady Trieu. Who happens to be Vite's daughter that was conceived using a stolen sample. that's actually kind of a hilarious scene. It's darkly funny and has so much subtext. It's amazing. But this is really about women. This is really about women and people of color and colonialism and racism. You know, yeah, it's based on the comic book. It's a continuation, but it traffics in so much heavy material, and you know, it's such a vital, important series.
I'm just saying, like, that's Alan Moore, you know. He traffics in heavy hard material.
Yeah, you know, Alan Moore doesn't like seeing his works adapted into any medium. But, you know, I have to say, as great as the movie is, this does the original material almost more justice. And, again, I'm going to go back to Hooded Justice and Will Reeves, because, you know, no one knew what he looked like or who he was. He appeared to be a white guy, probably a cop or a bodybuilder. Everybody thought maybe someone from the circus. And there are always hints about his sexuality. Well, Lindelof and his writers show why he had the costume he had, which is his remembering the night he was hung, showing that his wife said, yeah, you're going to have to pretend to be a white guy to make this work, and applying white face around his eyes and hands. And then you see that he ends up in bed with a man. So it all tracks. There is nothing character-wise in this series that doesn't go right along with what Moore wrote in his original work. And, you know, that is fucking phenomenal. I can't remember a continuation or an adaptation of a work of a comic book that respected the material as much as this does. I mean, even Snyder's version, you know, takes a couple of liberties, but it's still pretty loyal. But this is remarkable in the way that it expands on while remaining 100% true to the original.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about story and theme, but and we've talked a little bit about the music. But what about, you know, say the visuals, the costumes, the special effects, all that? What are your thoughts on that for this? Because I think it's a hell of a production.
Okay, comic book television has come so far. Even since the aforementioned Arrowverse, right?
Yeah.
If you look at the special effects and the costumes, no, CW doesn't have the money that HBO or like Disney Plus, who's dipping in now, has to put behind these productions.
Yeah.
But still, those series started 10 years ago, max. And they don't look that much better than the superhero material that was on TV in, like, the 90s, maybe even the 80s.
Yeah. Better camera work, slightly less quirky effects.
But all in all, it's the same thing that we've always had. Watchmen was a game changer. Watchmen came before the Disney Plus stuff, and I have enjoyed. I didn't enjoy all of them, but that's not tonight's show.
WandaVision was decent.
I have enjoyed most of what Disney Plus has been doing with the Marvel material. And I know that their Star Wars material is also top-notch.
I like The Mandalorian. I haven't seen the rest of it, but yeah.
Yeah. But Watchmen was the game changer. Like, Watchmen was the one where a studio, in this case HBO and Warner Brothers, said, all right, let's throw our weight behind one of these things. They're making a ton of money at the box office. Let's see what we can do putting it on the small screen. And they went for it. And you have to give HBO a ton of credit for putting this thing together. I don't know what the budget is. IMDb doesn't have the budget listed for this series. Usually they have a per-episode budget. But I'm guessing that this thing was, what, $4 to $5 million an episode minimum?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right here, and I'm seeing reports of between $130 and $150 million for the series.
For the 9 episodes, so well over $10 million an episode.
Yeah, that's Game of Thrones territory, folks.
And I know that WandaVision just recently became the most expensive miniseries ever made, but I wouldn't be surprised if Watchmen was the record that they broke.
Probably. And here's the thing, it wasn't even supposed to be a miniseries. It was supposed to be an ongoing series. Lindelof stepped away saying, I can't top this. My story's done. Bring someone else in. And HBO actually said, we don't trust anyone else to be able to do as good a job, which I think is a little offensive to the many great creators out there, but wow.
HBO balked after Regina King balked. Lindelof said,
and Regina King doesn't want to work without Lindelof, it sounds.
Yeah. Lindelof said, I can't do another one. And King said, I'll do anything Lindelof does, but I'm out if he's out. And HBO's like, yep, we're done.
Yeah, and here's the thing, folks. You know, the thing is Lindelof ends the show, and I'm not going to spoil it, in a way that, you know, you could go many places, but is absolutely satisfying. It's a complete story. But when I say it's open-ended in the way that the original Watchmen was open-ended.
Series, yeah. The closed series with some questions, lingering questions for the reader to respond to.
Right. I mean, you know, there's all these questions. You know, does Ozymandias get his trial? You know, what happens with Angela and her family? You know, some other things, you know. But, yeah, I can't blame Regina King for not wanting to work without Lindelof. But I'll also say this. If I was at HBO and I would just go to Regina King and say, hey, you're a hell of a producer and a director. Do you want to take over the show and do season two yourself?
Yeah. She might feel like she would be in over her head.
And I know that Lindelof said it took us 2 years to do 9 episodes. We did 40 or 50 episodes of Lost in the same period. I don't know how the hell I survived this.
it's immaculate, right? Like, think about the clock they have there in the center of Tulsa. The Millennium Clock.
Yep.
Like, that alone is just hundreds of thousands of man hours of special effects work for that one thing that's in almost every
episode. Yeah, that was probably about 200 hours worth of work there.
And it's gorgeous, but I can see where it's exhausting. Especially when you have told a story. Like, is it continuable? Yes. Is it told? Yes. So you have to weigh those. Like, it's a perfect sequel to the Watchmen novel. Do I need to complete a trilogy? is that necessary? That's the question now that you have to answer. And I don't know if they could get enough weight out of a third one or a second one, depending on how you want to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
to justify.
I mean, you know, I hate to say it, but in the hands of a lesser writing crew, you'd probably have somebody coming back from the dead, somebody escaping prison. You'd have somebody being depressed after the events of it and not being the character we came to know and love. And it just wouldn't be the same.
They had the perfect number of original Watchmen characters.
Oh, yeah.
They implied heavily that the rest of them were gone. Right.
Or in prison, because somebody said it's implied that Dan may still be around, but is probably in prison. But everybody else is dead.
Yeah. Like, I guess you could. I think starting with the idea there of the with Tulsa and with the colonization of Vietnam and working those two strands together so perfectly, I don't see, and obviously I'm not like, you know, professional television creator. I just don't see a way to make something as good, let alone better, out of what they have left to work with.
Yeah. Yep. The only way I can see the Watchmen universe being continued is, and I don't want to see it live action, but maybe an adult animated, and I mean animation for adults as in treated maturely, like some of the anime that's out there, or the old Spawn series that HBO did. Yes, I actually like that, folks. Sue me. But doing an animated adaptation of the Before Watchmen comics, which I actually I like those. I don't think they're nearly as good as the original or as good as this, but there's a lot of fun stuff there that you could pick and choose and maybe do it as an anthology type show and run it, say, 10 to 20 episodes for, say, two seasons, you know, make 20 or 40 episodes and do a good little run there, you know?
Yep.
And now some TV producer out there is going to hear about this and say, But now some TV producer is going to go, shit, now I can't do that because he'll sue me for my idea. No, I won't. Just make it happen.
I think you and I already had our best television pitch, and it died during COVID. So,
hey, we'll still have to work on that. We have to work on that. But you know, like I've always said, I'm much more fit towards, you know, I get ideas and stuff, and I think I have a good idea on how to make things work. But I'm happy doing what I do, writing about TV and film and talking about TV and film. That really is my wheelhouse. But you know, again, there's the book and the movie, and the movie and the book are so linked. But then there's the show, and here is going to be a question. If somebody said, rank the three in order of preference, you know, the book, the movie, or the show, how would you rank them?
I have to put the book first, just because
it is the root, right? Like, it's God, we're 35 years later, and it's still just so resonant. So I have to put the book first. Then I'm going to put the miniseries, because it's just such a perfect sequel, such a perfect continuation of Moore's full vision. And because they saved the squid, like, I didn't think it was, they took the part of the book that I was most suspicious about and made it something that was truly, like, profoundly made sense. And then when they actually redid the ending of the book in the mirror episode, and they actually did a convincing job of the squid, it raised my respect for the book more than it had already been. And then the film, which is no knock on the film. This is, I told you a couple of days ago, might be a top five superhero film of all time. I don't know if it probably is. It's excellent. It's just of the three, I even hesitate to say it's the least. It's just not the most. It's a story I really love. It's a universe I really resonate with. It's Vonnegut does superheroes, right? it's that dark satire mixed with just really off the wall science fiction. When I do complain on occasion about DC characters, it's that they're not human enough. Well, that's not the case in Watchmen. I think Moore knew that that was the complaint of DC books.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, his only canon DC work is Batman. So I think he connects to the
Swamp Thing. He also has Swamp Thing. He did Swamp Thing.
That's true.
He did some really important work on Swamp Thing.
Yeah, I knew he did Swamp Thing. I just was thinking that it was non-continuity. But
Right. The whole idea of the Swamp Thing as a spirit of nature and a force of something more than humanity, that's all Moore.
That's right.
Moore really changed that, and that's been an aspect of Swamp Thing in most of its best runs since the 80s. Okay, go on.
He wrote one of, maybe the five best Batman stories ever with The Killing Joke, which does not translate to film, but the book is incredible. He just understands that dark, seedy side of humanity without, I don't think, being a misanthrope, which is important.
Yeah, and he's a very grumpy guy and very testy, but he's also a genius. And he's been kicked around a lot. Lindelof reached out to Moore and was told by Moore's people, he's not going to talk to you. He doesn't want to have anything to do with this. Please don't use his name. And that's the end of the discussion. And so Lindelof, of course, said, well, we know we can't use the name, but I was hoping to at least get his blessing but he doesn't even want to talk. Well, who did want to talk and who is credited, and it's interesting, in the series credits, it says, based on characters co-created by Dave Gibbons. Well, Dave Gibbons was the artist on the series. He's also the artist, literally, on the TV show. The some of the artwork that you see at during the openings and within the show itself, that's Dave Gibbons' original artwork.
Yeah.
So, you know, now Zack Snyder managed to get Dave Gibbons to help out a little bit, but not to the level that that Gibbons worked on the series. And I think that, you know, the fact that Lindelof was able to convince Gibbons to help out really speaks to how much he understands the material.
I think also, I mean, yes, Moore notoriously hates his adaptations, but until Watchmen, until Zack Snyder did Watchmen, the best by far adaptation of his work was V for Vendetta, and still, if that's the best one, look at League of
Extraordinary
Gentlemen
is a flaming pile.
Like, it's not good. Like, there is,
and the thing is, From Hell is a brilliant, brilliant book. In some ways, Moore's most disturbing work. But you know, the Hughes brothers decided to make it a Johnny Depp stars as psychic drug addicted detective chasing Jack the Ripper and a woman.
Yeah.
And that's not Moore.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's too bad that you haven't seen The Leftovers, because I see a lot of similarities in some of the approaches that Lindelof had with characters and stories there as here. But, you know, maybe one day you'll get a chance to watch that and we can have a discussion about it. But, you know, now you've not read any of the before Watchmen, just the original book, right?
No, just the original book.
Yeah. Now, for those who don't know, Before Watchmen was a series of books that DC released several years back that told stories of the various characters before the Watchmen book takes place. Some of this was well before the origin stories that were hinted at or shown in the book, and some what were literally leading into it. Most of it was in between the stories that we saw. Now, some of it was better than others. But as a whole, it really is worth seeing. And I suggest it as an animated series because of the artwork. I also suggest it as an anthology series because that's really what this was. This was not a cohesive whole. These were stories by all-star creative teams that were brought in for miniseries and specials, and it ran like 6 to 12 months with different sequences and cycles of stories coming and going. And, you know, some of my favorite stuff was the early Minutemen stuff and the Hollis Mason stuff. The Ozymandias stuff I wasn't sure about, but it grew on me over time. But, you know,
he's such an interesting character.
Oh yeah, no. Ozymandias is an interesting character, and they do a great job of exploring his single-mindedness, shall we say, in the Before Watchmen stuff. But the one thing that bothers me is, you know, they changed the comedian to a slightly more cheerful fellow who gets pissed at or deeply disturbed by Kennedy dying. Now, one of the things that Snyder changed was was that the comedian knocks off Kennedy from the grassy knoll. That's not in the book, but it works for the comedian because he's a heartless son of a bitch. Although maybe not completely heartless. He's complex. All the characters are complex, and you know, that's another thing. If Before Watchmen has a problem, it's that some of the attempts to add complexity don't quite work, whereas others do. Now, it's unfortunate that you haven't seen the Before the Mask material, but you've read it in the book, obviously.
Yeah.
And for me, I'd rather stick to that information. Now we haven't spoken about the Black Freighter from the movie and the book, but what do you make of the Black Freighter, and what do you see as its point in place? And do you think there is any thing that is a corollary to it in the miniseries?
So the Black Freighter is a stand-in for comic books. It's a literal comic book. But it also really parallels the story of Watchmen. It's just that you don't realize it until after you finish. I think it's handled better in the book than it is in the Ultimate Cut, because I think in the Ultimate Cut that Snyder wove in an animated short film that was not originally shot for Watchmen. I think that it's well handled in the film. I just think that it's better in the book. I think that it's woven in a little better. I think that when the kid finishes the book, it's a little more clear what its purpose is.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really does parallel the odious plot of Ozymandias.
What a vile guy.
And in the miniseries, the corollary to the Black Freighter, at least how I read it, is the Hooded Justice TV show. Because it shows the whitewashing that the American media does on Black characters. It takes a character that we knew nothing about, and it gives him a story that is true-ish, but there's a lot of mythologizing, and there's a lot of stuff that we find out later is not the truth at all. So I would say, and it's not a perfect parallel to Black Freighter, because it's not mirroring the story. It's enhancing the story.
The purpose of Black Freighter in the book is to make it clear that Alan Moore thinks that his line of work is partly responsible for the state of America, which is deeply cynical and deeply ironic and also pretty hilarious. The point of the Hooded Justice TV show in Watchmen is to drive home the point of the series, which is, hey, let's maybe stop whitewashing everything. Maybe let's show Black characters being heroic. Let's show Black characters being wrong, but not gang members. Let's show Black soldiers and Black cops who are both heroes, but also make mistakes. Let's show Black characters as well-rounded people and stop casting them as white people. Adam just got booted from the show. So, yes, The Hooded Justice is, in my opinion, the corollary, as I just said. Let's see here. He actually is played by Cheyenne Jackson. Jackson? Johnson? I am so sorry. Give me just a minute. Jackson, Cheyenne Jackson, of the Ryan Murphy acting troupe. And so they also did a brilliant job of casting in making the point of casting gay actors to play gay characters. And so they're showing that...
Hello, I'm back.
Hypocritical. They're okay. Hypocritical casting.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. I had a technical issue with my call-in, so it took me a minute to get the phone line working again. So, yes, Aaron, you were in casting. Good. So let's keep going with that.
No, I was just saying that the point of Hooded Justice, the TV show, is to drive home the point that casting white actors as non-white characters is always and they kept that point by casting Cheyenne Jackson, who's a famous Ryan Murphy character actor, and so they casted a gay actor to play a gay character, and so they were not being hypocritical while making this point, because LGBT representation of actors has also been a huge point of having straight actors playing gay characters, and that's been a big debate lately.
Oh, yeah. No, and, but, you know, this, it was interesting because, you know, he played Hooded Justice in that, I think it was supposed to be a TV movie, based on the way the production values looked in it. Which is interesting because, you know, we talked about the changing production values. But no, it's the show really. I mean, we talked about the casting, but it's not just that everybody's so perfect. It's the other dimensions that who these people are add rather than subtract or detract from, you know, one's enjoyment. It really is a marvelous, marvelous show. I mean, you know, like I said, I have it much further down my list than you do. But where do you rank this thing all time?
I believe it is number 45 on my list. Yes,
yeah.
45.
Yeah, Yeah.
And I could probably move it up slightly, you know, like I would be comfortable with that, but.
Yeah, like moving it up between 2 to 5 spots. Yeah, yeah, and like I said, I'm gonna move it up to 105. That's where it's gonna land, and then I'll have to probably rewatch a few of the shows ahead of it. But yeah, it's knocking on the door, and it's the whole damn package. But yeah, no, this is important. I think this is an important show, and I think we're going to have to get into this a little bit. There were 3 shows in the last few years that really touched on racial issues in a sci-fi, fantasy, or horror setting. 2 of them really touched on the Tulsa Massacre. The 2 that touched on the Tulsa Massacre were Watchmen and Lovecraft Country. The other one that touched on racism in a sci-fi, fantasy, or horror setting was the Amazon series Them. Now, Lovecraft Country and Watchmen got a lot of acclaim. Watchmen won all the awards. Them, I hope, ends up with some nominations when it comes time for the Emmys, as I believe it came out in the summer. But Lovecraft Country fails in every way that Watchmen succeeds. Now, you've read the book for Lovecraft Country, and you saw a few of the episodes for Lovecraft Country. What do you think? And I mean, I know we're 2 white guys and everything, but even so, we're also historians. We watch lots of movies and TV shows. We read books, fiction and nonfiction. But just as a human being and a viewer, I cared more about the characters in Watchmen. I cared more about Will, and I felt that the show did more justice in its depiction of the consequences of the Tulsa Massacre in this show than in Lovecraft Country. So what do you think on that?
Frankly, I didn't even get to the Tulsa Massacre in Lovecraft Country. The show kept a lot of the melodramatic aspects of the book, but it lost all of what I consider to be like the pulpy fun part. The entire point of the book, Lovecraft Country, was to mimic the style of 1940s and 50s pulp and science fiction. And really put a point onto how racist it was by making anti-racist stories with the same kind of language and story settings.
Yeah.
And that was missing. Like, I want, like, yes, it's important. It's a very important topic. But you lose some of the importance when you just put on your professor suit and make sure that your elbow patches are nicely polished. I felt like it was trying too hard to be important to be important. Whereas Watchmen just did its thing and it just destroyed it, like, in the best way possible. It set out clear parameters of the story it was telling, and it wove it into its fabric. It doesn't talk about Tulsa that much, but the whole thing is about it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes place in Tulsa, and it takes place in a world where reparations have been made. And it plays with the idea of what that would do to poor white people.
and it plays with the idea of what would happen if blacks in America were not systemically oppressed. Does all of this while never losing sight of the fact that it's still a comic book show and it's still telling a story for entertainment on top of telling an important story. It doesn't get so wrapped up in the fact that I'm important that it loses what its soul is, or
right.
or what its heart is, I should say, because the soul of Watchmen is this idea of racial justice, but its heart and its mind are in the world of intellectual science fiction and intellectual comic book narratives.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it... I can't really say that, you know, Watchmen... you know, when you read the book, that you think as much about the racial aspects. But I think that's one of the things that's wonderful about this series is that it talks about how things develop and makes you think about what you saw in a new way, and not in a way that says what you saw before wasn't really what you saw before. Although in the case of Hooded Justice, it kind of is. But in a way that says there was more going on than you knew. It asks you to consider things in a different, more meaningful way.
It's a really
because
great
Moore definitely dealt a little bit in racial issues, but it was around the perimeter, whereas this is front and center.
Yeah. The racial presence in the book is mainly felt through the fact that it takes place in the 60s mostly and the 80s. And the threat of urban violence, which
yeah,
is
yeah,
always
like late 30s, early 40s,
when you
and
hear
then
the
60s and the 80s, yep.
When you hear the words law and order, that's a dog whistle, right? You know, we all know what they're saying. Oh, we're going to keep the black urban population under control. And Watchmen uses our knowledge that that's all just a big dog whistle, dog and pony show kind of language. And it uses that threat of urban violence as the racial backdrop without ever saying it. So it's easy to miss that there are large racial undertones in Watchmen because it is a white cast. Like, there's no way around that. But Moore and Gibbons are also British. And so the British deal with race in different ways than we do. Lindelof's also British, isn't he?
No. Nope.
Oh, he's not?
No.
Okay. I was thinking he was. Anyway. I think that was the end of my statement.
But now we come to, you know, we're getting towards the end of the live broadcast, and what I was going to ask was what I always ask here, and is there anything on any of the actually, you know, I'll do this. I'll ask this first, and then we'll see if we have to go into overtime. But is there anything on the comics, the movie, or the show that you haven't gotten to that you'd like to get into? I just need a yes or a no.
Not off the top of my head. I'm sure that I could talk more about any of them if something comes up, but I can't think of anything that I need to say.
Yeah, no. So what I will do is I will use this time now to say that we do have some things coming up on Deviant Legion. One thing that we're going to have is on Monday there is going to be a tribute to Betty White, who passed away on New Year's Eve. Carl and Rachel, I believe, have one of their music shows coming up. Carl has some other stuff in the pipeline. And you'll need to tune in to the new Deviant Legion website. Let me see if I've got the full address. This is embarrassing. It's actually not coming up. Yep, deviantlegion.com, the Deviant Legion Network. And that literally went active just today. And you'll be able to start to pay attention to that for information on upcoming shows. Now for another news. Now for Cathode Ray Mission, we will be back next week with a special episode on Billy Wilder. Aaron will be back. We're hoping that Perry Seibert can join us. Yep, Perry Seibert should be back. And we will have Joe, excuse me, I cannot talk today. We'll have Joseph McBride, who recently had a wonderful book, Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, published. And he will come in and speak on Billy Wilder and his book. And then we will be taking a one-week break and coming back on the 4th of February for a look at the German miniseries/movie. There's been like three or four cuts of this thing from Wolfgang Petersen called Das Boot. So I hope that you fine folks will join us again next week and then again 2 weeks after that. And I hope you've enjoyed us rambling on about all things Watchmen tonight. But I do want to, thank you, and of course, thank you to Aaron for coming in and having this conversation. This is a little different, but I think it worked. I think it worked. Aside from the technical snafu there that knocked me out for like 3 or 4 minutes, but we survived that. So they just gave me the 1 minute warning, and I think that we will take this out. So on the count of three, let's say goodnight and see you all next week. One, two, three, good night.
Good night.